This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country and join their calls for justice. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
Oh, Tom, you look so tired.
I'm very tired. I've been doing comedy. I've been yelling my comedy.
It's all that comedy.
People on YouTube will notice.
You better still be funny.
This small mark on the top of my forehead. Can you see that?
Did you smash a microphone into your head or
That's
something?
That's me repeatedly slamming the microphone into my head at the same point.
Oh, my God, it actually is.
I do it every single night.
People do that at punk shows sometimes, so I recognize.
I'm pretty fucking punk. I tell you what, last night I had a baby in the audience.
That's extremely punk.
I had a 13-year-old. I was talking to her for a little bit, and then I asked if there were any Americans in the room. Silence, and then just, and a little baby spoke up.
Any babies in the room?
It was so good.
Do you think they liked it?
I think the baby was on board. Yeah, it was a leftist baby, so it was good.
Well, anyway, enough about your show. I understand that you may not be aware of the Molly the Magpie story.
No.
Somehow... This is another one that I'm like, has this really not spread beyond Queensland? I feel like surely any of our Queensland listeners will know what I'm talking about when I say Molly the Magpie. But this is like a saga that's been unfolding over the last few weeks, and it seems like it's finally kind of come to a resolution this week. This is the story of a magpie and a staffie, a magpie and a puppy that became dear friends.
Awesome.
Until the evil wildlife officers at the Department of Environment and Science took the magpie away and separated them. And the staffie was so sad because they were really missing their friend, Molly the Magpie. You seriously haven't heard it? This is insane to me.
No, Emeralds, no. I've been reading about, you know, the climate crisis and the war on Gaza and stuff.
Crisis.
But I guess
actually,
the magpie is pretty important too, yeah.
This is a political issue. In fact, it's one of the main issues that Premier Stephen Miles seems to have taken on for the election, because he actually ended up intervening. So what happened was... Apparently, I think it was like 2020, 2021-ish, this family found an injured magpie on the street. They picked it up. They're like, let's take this magpie home, rehabilitate it, mm-hmm. and like raised it. It must have been like a baby magpie. And they kind of raised it alongside their adopted English staffie dog, adorable dog. And they have an Instagram that's dedicated to Molly the Magpie and Peggy the staffie. And they're such good friends. And it is like, everyone's a sucker for unlikely animal friendship content, right? But yes. They really do. Like, the magpie like comes and like snuggles up to the dog, and they like play with each other. It's very sweet. Mm. Unfortunately, however, it is illegal to simply take a native animal into your home if you're not a licensed wildlife carer.
Oh,
and,
God.
You know, raise the them the way that they're not meant
PC
to be raised.
Brigade strikes again.
That's right. Nanny state nonsense. And so I think... like, because they gathered this massive following, obviously authorities became aware. I think even people were like repeatedly reporting it to the authorities. There were rumors about whether the magpie was like kept on a leash or how they kind of got them to do these things.
What?
Unsubstantiated.
Okay.
Unsubstantiated. But a
I
lot
mean,
of,
if any animal
you know,
could escape quite easily, it is surely the magpie.
You would think that the magpie would just fly away. I don't know, but it seemed to just love being with this little puppy. But eventually, so a few weeks ago, the owners apparently voluntarily surrendered Molly the Magpie to authorities after being reported and the authorities
come out with your wings up. We have you surrounded. Yeah. Release Molly.
But then it became apparent, like, they're like, we thought maybe we would just get Molly back. By the way, at some point they realized that because they're not wildlife carers, they had called it Molly thinking that the magpie was a girl. Molly is a dude. And so it's the dude magpie called Molly.
This is why you should never assume anyone's gender, everyone. Use they, them pronouns.
Exactly.
If you don't know, thank you. Yep.
They thought Molly was going to be returned. It was taking ages. They hadn't heard anything. They're like, where the fuck is Molly? They start making noise online, being like, bring Molly home. We're so sad. We miss these days, posting old videos of them together. And so it gathers heaps of attention, attracts the attention of like all these celebrity, you know, politicians are commenting. 11-time surfing world champion Kelly Slater weighs in and posts a statement on Instagram that says, this wild magpie made these staffies its family. Then someone in a government department decided they didn't approve and took the bird away.
Oh, God.
There was a petition with more than 150,000 signatures calling on the department to reunite them. And then... Stephen Miles, hero of the hour, Queensland Premier, comes out and is like, enough. There has to be a way. That's what he says. He's like, there has to be a way that Molly can be brought home and reunited. And yes, I understand all the laws and you probably shouldn't, you know, bring native animals into your home and raise them like a pet. But there has to be an exception here. And maybe it has something to do with the fact that this is a popular cause gaining traction on social media and I'm up for re-election in October. But this is a story of love. This is a story of unity. This is a story of coming together and and doing what's right. We didn't hear anything. That was maybe like a couple of weeks ago he intervened. And then this week he posted another statement on his Instagram. It was like a, you know, a notes app apology style statement. Like it's just like text on a white, white thing. And it's like, I have an update. What does it say? Sorry, I'm waiting for the statement to load. An update on Molly the Magpie, full stop. I just wanted to share an update about Molly the Magpie. I've spoken to Reese and Juliet, the owners, who owns a native animal, we'll see, and reassured them Molly is in great spirits and receiving good care. This is a fucking magpie.
I'm sorry. How do you
this
tell
is the Premier of Queensland.
Is in 20, great spirits.
They're in great spirits. He's in great spirits. Molly Magpie's in great spirits. Yeah, I asked him and he was like, this morning, the department has advised me that the couple can secure the appropriate license. The team will now work with them to do that. It's good news. It means Molly can come home very soon. I'd like to thank everyone who has written to me to share their concerns and advocate for Molly's return. That's right. Thank you.
If you've written a letter about the magpie and you haven't written to your EP about like Gaza, go fuck yourself, all right? There's something wrong with you. I'm sorry.
I know.
Come on, guys.
Yeah. So Molly's going home. Apparently the parents are getting their permit to look after it. The funny part is, I mean, I looked back at the articles and when they had voluntarily surrendered the magpie, the owner was like, oh, we'd done everything in our power to try and get the wildlife permit, but I had to retract my application, quote, as it was a bit of a conflict to our page. So obviously, because they're like, you are probably profiting, like you're probably doing SponCon and whatever, you're benefiting by being an influencer with this, by quote unquote caring for this magpie. Right. You can't be a wildlife carer who's actually just trying to be an influencer. And so a condition apparently of them having this permit is that they cannot profit or benefit from looking after the magpie. So I don't know what happens to the Instagram page. I know that there were rumors, maybe, I'm not even sure if it's just a rumor. I think they said there was a book deal that they had about it. Presumably the book is dead. Very sad. We're not going to be hearing the Molly the Magpie story anytime soon. But everything's fine. A magpie expert has also weighed in and been like, yeah, it's quite possible the magpie thinks it's a dog. So all happy ending thanks to Queensland Labor. Delivered.
The Greens, after their disgusting display of anti-Semitism over the last couple of years. This may backfire on the Greens quite badly. It's the Jews today. Who's to say it's not the Hindus tomorrow?
We're stuck with the hosts of Chapo Shithouse podcast.
This is a serious danger to Australia.
Well, that's great. Thank you for bringing the story of Molly the Magpie into my life and to this podcast, which is Serious Danger, a podcast about Green politics in Australia. It's not an official Greens Party podcast. Do the Greens have a position on Molly?
I don't. Well, I mean, as people know, I work in a state Greens MP's office in Queensland, and we were like, "Do we need a fucking position on Molly the Magpie?" And then we were like,
"Yeah, because your silence is fucking change. Deafening." All right,
our silence is deafening. I'm going to say people were asking.
Surely we're for all unlikely animal friendships and also for regulation for appropriate animal welfare. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Molly's in good spirits. So that's real, what I want to hear.
Yeah, wedge issue for the Greens, I guess. This is not official Greens Party podcast. It is made possible with the help of the Green Institute and produced by Michael the Griff Griffin. This week, we are chatting about our good mate, Purple Pingers, and his absolute incredible media blitz and crusade on squatting in people's houses, driving right-wing conservative landlords and property owners
insane. In America for some reason.
Yeah. Very excited about that. And we'll check in on the latest on Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, particularly the speech that Penny Wong gave this week, which, looking into it, is nothing.
Not actually a thing. Okay.
Still interesting to talk about, but making a very banal position and a meaningless position, basically, in the context of the horrific genocidal war that continues. Big thanks to our new patrons, Andy, Sebastian, Michelle, Gabrielle, Tristan, and Christopher. Thank you for supporting the show. For just $3 a month, you can get bonus content.
Bonus.
We've got some more coming. There was some extra content from our live show that will be in your feed in the coming weeks, and we've got some great guests lined up. Really worth your while, and of course helps us pay our wonderful producer and cover our basic costs of doing this podcast. Thank you so much to everyone who came to our Melbourne show. How good was that, Emerald?
It was so fun.
Even though it was
in Melbourne, I actually had a really good time. It was very sweet, and I'm looking forward. I mean, we've got the two shows in Mansion Brisbane now. The 2 p.m. with Trina Massey has sold out, but last we checked, I think 12 p.m. with Max Chandler May, there is also close to sold out. So who knows if there are still tickets available by the time that you are listening to this. But if you're coming, looking forward to seeing you there. We'll have some, if we've got any shirts and stickers left over, we'll also have them there. But I will also say those are selling fast. There are just a few like sizes left. So we've got like the jade dark green blue kind of color. We've got coal, which is the dark gray, and the black and white, but only in a handful of sizes. So check the shop that's linked in our link tree from our Instagram if you want to grab one of those.
Yeah, that's seriousdangerpod.com. Thanks to patron Ollie, who sent us a message. Come to Sydney, Warane. I didn't know. What is the First Nation traditional name for Sydney? Is that it? Warane?
Maybe.
I've never heard that before.
I hadn't heard that. I was thinking about it the other day.
I was like, yeah, what?
Right?
Right.
But yeah, the place name.
Anyway, come to Sydney, Warane. Apologies if I'm mispronouncing that. You godless lefties. We appreciate that, Ollie.
Well, I was thinking about this. I was like, surely New South Wales is next.
We got to get there.
Because we hate to say it.
We love
SA, well, quite for you, you know, WA, you're very far away, but I'd love to visit Perth.
We love doing live shows. We'd love to do more of them, and we'll do our best. We should say a little bit of great news. Amy McMahon is back at work, everyone.
She's back, baby. I saw her yesterday. She is ready to fucking smash the 2020 state election. For folks who maybe missed this or didn't catch us talking about it, Amy McMahon, the Greens MP in South Brisbane in Queensland Parliament, was in a pretty serious car crash in February. It was, you know, pretty harrowing stuff at the time. She was in hospital for a little while. She's sustained a head injury and like a dislocated shoulder, and is still in, you know, a bit of rehabilitation. She's had like speech therapy and, you know, occupational therapy and that sort of thing. But she is very much like, saw her yesterday, she's very much herself. And even though she's like, yes, I've got a bit of recovery ahead of me, you can't fucking keep me away. So she's back at work as of this week and has confirmed she will be recontesting the election. Very fantastic news.
Rock on, Amy. Godspeed. Well, thank you to producer Michael Griff Griffin, who's put in the show notes here. Warung. Sydney Warung.
Ah, Warung.
Is the pronunciation of that. Sydney Warung. Thanks, there you Mike. Go.
I know we're in a pretty serious housing crisis, but do you really think that encouraging people to squat on private property is the way to fix it?
Yeah, look, let me answer your question by asking you another question. Do you think it's right that we have thousands of vacant, abandoned homes while we have people living on the street?
No, I don't. I don't.
Oh, but sorry. This is a pretty big ethical question that we need to ask ourselves. And we've got, you know, the government promising a couple houses in a decade or two from now while we have people living on the street and empty homes. And I think, like, you know, we've got adverse possession laws in Australia, and we've got, you know, squatting is legal in Australia. So what's the solution? I think it's staring at us.
This has blown up a bit, especially online in America. How are you going with that attention? Are they angry at you? And Americans can be very angry with people.
Yeah, Americans just want to kill homeless people. That's what I've noticed. It's not nice.
Use the word abandoned. Who owns a house and abandons it, Jordan?
Many people, I don't know if you've ever gone down the street and seen, like, houses empty for decades, but I certainly have.
No, I haven't.
Oh, really? Interesting. Nope. How many, do you have any abandoned investment properties, Steve?
No, I don't. Excellent. But, I mean, I'm just trying to get to the economics of this. If someone buys a property, I mean, yes, we've had land banking, obviously, from foreigners, but that's not widespread. There's not thousands of them.
On the census night, we had 10% of all housing stock vacant.
Oakley Dokley. So, friend of the show, Jordan, aka Geordie Vandenberg, aka Purple Pingers on the internet, has launched this crowdsourced register of vacant homes. He kind of started making the call out for vacant properties end of last week, and this week it really hit the media with a bit of outcry from landlords and people, especially Americans, just losing their mind over the idea that he would post these vacant properties and say, hey, since he's vacant, if you need a home, if you don't have a home, here's a home that you could potentially go and squat in.
But they belong to someone else.
They belong to someone else who's not fucking using them is likely just land banking them and contributing to the housing crisis while they focus on capital gains.
It's nice to have, though, isn't it? It's nice to have another house there just in case. Just in case.
Yeah, but one that you acknowledge, like you would be like, well, it's not inhabitable. You know that it doesn't meet minimum standards probably to rent out. But you also know that if you just don't spend any money on doing it up and just hold on to it for another year or two, the amount that you would have made potentially in rent is actually subsumed by the capital gains that you would make because of our cooked fucking housing market where you can just sit on land and the price of it just goes up and then you write it off on your tax. And yeah, it's all really good stuff.
I must say, I hadn't really thought about this. Whenever I thought of land banking, I thought of developers banking empty land that they didn't develop at all. That's like literally there's nothing there. But yes, the idea that property investors have an actual house, like actual place where some human could live, provided it is up to code and like you make the changes there. The idea that you would keep that and that that's actually worth your while, that the price of land is spiraling so much that it's actually worth just having an empty house sitting there and increasing in value over time rather than housing anyone and getting rent as insane and extortionate as rent is at the moment. That's an extra level of cooked dimension to the housing market that I hadn't considered before. Thanks, Purple Fingers.
There's this old explainer of it from Cameron Murray as to why investors would leave a home vacant that crystallized it a bit for me, that it's like, well, if you have a property that could be tenanted out, but it's maybe worth $500,000 if you sell it with a tenancy, or $520,000 if you sell it with vacant possession, so that someone can move in straight away, the $20,000 that could account for, you know, a year's rent potentially, like that, well, whatever, it accounts for a significant time of rent. So it actually makes more sense for you to just leave it vacant for the chance that you're then going to be able to sell it vacant. And also it doesn't matter because then, you get the capital gains because the value will go up as you're sitting on it. So,
Jesus.
Yep, people are really doing that. Despite what Steve Price, Purple Fingers, he launches this platform. He's put it as another section of shitrentals.org, which is what we've spoken to Geordie about before, which is this website that kind of catalogs, really poor standard rental properties and tries to sort of name and shame real estates and real estate agencies and landlords who are trying to rent out shitholes effectively. but he's now got a separate, tab where there's kind of a few vacant properties listed. If they have been empty, abandoned for more than 2 years is the threshold that he's kind of set.
Two years.
Yeah. So it's not like they're just, he's like, does this look empty for the last week or two? That's his threshold that he set. He's also said there are quite a few properties that he's not publishing. And actually what he's doing largely is kind of using that register to bring attention to the cause. And then people are contacting him directly if they need a home, and he will let them know about a place that they could potentially live in if they really need a roof over their head,
Right.
And so he's posted about this, what Geordie does is he does TikToks and he's on Twitter and all of that. And of course people saw this and lost their fucking minds, and especially Americans. I guess what is it about Americans that this makes them so angry? Why?
Well, it's I don't think there's anything unique about America necessarily. I suppose the relationship between our social media and their social media is probably closer than other countries, and it is the suggestion of any kind of anti-capitalist politics. He gets enough attention in the media. People certainly had some issues with his appearance, and that he represents everything that they hate about woke lefties who dare to suggest that human beings deserve housing. And then bingo, bango. And I mean, the Americans are fucking batshit mental as well. And then once it starts memeing, I mean, I've noticed as soon as something starts like, you know, being posted about certain accounts, or if certain accounts get onto one of these stories from the batshit right-wing American community, it will go around very, very quickly.
Yeah. I think apparently, like, it looks as though there's an article or two published in some far-right, you know, quite conservative outlet that then has spurred a bit of people freaking the fuck out. One of my favorites was at Loud Proud Texan, screen name Balanced Duality, who tweeted at AusFed Police.
Incredible.
If any Australian owning these residential properties happens to get murdered, investigate at Purple Pingers for conspiracy to commit malice and bodily injury, theft of property by telling strangers to steal their homes. I'll be making an international call too. Thumbs up emoji. Many people just like tagging FBI. People really just like tagging the authorities.
Tagging Elon Musk, being like, is this allowed? So these, of course, are still free speech psychos as well. Mm. But now it's like, hey, Elon, you shouldn't allow this guy to post. Like, this is actually illegal. This guy is encouraging people to commit a crime. And that's really the nub of it, right? Like the idea that there was a suggestion or a call for squatting. And I don't want to jump ahead if you've got other stuff about explaining exactly what that is there. But that's the call. The idea that, properties that are vacant for more than 2 years, for fuck's sake, the suggestion that someone should use them and that you might transgress their precious property rights by living in an empty house, for God's sakes. That's what drove people mental.
Yeah, so this is the thing that he's kind of trying to draw attention to, that it is probably, like, it may not be illegal. I don't really know what the legal distinction is there between it's legal and it may not be illegal, but it seems to be phrased as may not be illegal at if the property looks abandoned and is unlocked. You can basically go in there and squat. If it's locked, like if you have to break in any way, then you are like you're breaking and entering. So that's a crime. Yes. If the owner asks you to leave and you don't leave, you're trespassing. So that's a crime. But otherwise, potentially legal. And then the other, you know, the kind of really interesting argument is that then if you're there for a certain number of years, it is a long time. So in all states except Victoria, and there's no provision for this in the ACT or the NT, but if you have squatted somewhere for 12 years, you can claim possession effectively under adverse possession laws. So this has happened where people have squatted somewhere for 12 plus years and they can go to court and say, well, it's mine now. Like, finders keepers, losers weepers. Effectively, snooze you lose, you know, use it or lose it. That's a real thing. I mean, that's obviously going to be rare, but that is.
Well, I mean, if you want to get on the property ladder. Young people out there, you're probably taking 12 years to save up a deposit anyway. So why don't you just try and find an abandoned place and bingo, bango, you've got yourself a property portfolio.
Have you seen any of the examples of people doing this? Like there was this story in SBS earlier this year about Percy. I don't know if that's their real name, but someone in Brisbane who, has been squatting in this place. But what I didn't realize until I read the article was Tom just took a swig out of the cup.
Oh, sorry.
That one of our listeners brought to the Melbourne show that has my face, my candidate picture on one side, and then on the other side it's just like Arial letters, black and white, Tom.
Sorry, I forgot that good. I was drinking this. Very appropriate.
No, sorry, I had to, watch the YouTube if you want to see it. Sorry, but Percy, Percy was renting in this place, moved out, the rent increased unsustainably or maybe he didn't get a lease renewal, and then realized after he'd left that, like, it wasn't rented out again. So he's like, why didn't I just go back and, like, moved back in as a squatter? Yeah, he's been there for a little bit. There's this story of 1998, it's actually a property developer. Fuck, I didn't realize that. That's like I have a conflict as to whether I like this guy or not. But Bill Gertos walked into a 3-bedroom house, taking it as his own after learning the elderly owner had died. He renovated, changed the locks, and put renters in the place for 20 years. Wow, what a fucking – I didn't realize this guy sucks so bad.
But 20 years?
Yeah, and in 2018, he won the title to the house. He sold it in 2020, making $1.4 million. That guy kind of sucks, but – we should do that, but do it as actually living in the home, not fucking renting out like a fucking parasite.
I'd be fascinated to know how they land on 12 years when that kind of law comes up. Yeah, I know. Well, and
it's 15 in Victoria.
15 in Victoria, right. Yeah. Okay, good. In the Socialist Republic of Victoria.
Right. Yeah, well, it's much harder to get your squatters' rights. What's interesting, I mean, just on the Americans, like what's probably concerning is how much they seem to be relying on this. They're like, if someone did that, I would just shoot them. Americans, they love just being like, yeah, well, in Australia, you don't have guns. We've got guns, so we'd shoot you. And I think part of the, yeah, like maybe the big American response spurred it on a little more, and Geordi then ended up going on The Project this week, which is the clip that maybe a lot of people have seen because this interview is just incredible. Did you watch it?
I only saw a couple of clips. I'm sorry. Yes, okay. I haven't got the whole thing.
No, it's just great because, like I said before, you know, Steve Price, as always, is just an idiot, and he's like, well, but who is doing this? Like, who is actually who's just leaving properties empty? And Geordi's like, well, yeah. I've received, you know, 200 or 300 submissions of properties that have been abandoned for more than 2 years in the 48 hours since I put it up. So. Clearly people are doing it, and as we said, yes. There's reasons why they would do it. And he's just sort of, Steve Price is like, I don't know. And they're like the kind of, yeah, the tone is very like, well, we all agree homelessness is bad and, you know, we need to do something about it. But is this really the solution? And it's like, it's not. This isn't the solution. But like, no, you're not fucking doing anything. Like they're like, shouldn't we focus on policy solutions? And Geordi's like, yeah, sure. But like, right now people are homeless, and if there's a roof that we can put over their head, then why the fuck, why would I not do that, you know?
Yeah. The outrage reserved for a young progressive person doing something with humor and with skill and cutting through by taking some photos and setting up a website. Like, this is outrageous. We should talk about this. But the ongoing housing crisis, the fact that we have, you know, people with hundreds of houses and other people sleeping on the street, well, that's just kind of like how Australia works, and Steve Price doesn't get up on his soapbox about that, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of the things that may be complicated, like, I don't know if this muddies the waters, but there's that figure that probably we've been using. I don't know if we've spoken about this on the show before, but about 1 million homes being vacant on census night, as kind of reported by the ABS in the census. And I'd heard that this had been debunked. I mean, Purple Pingers Geordi like mentioned again in his interview on The Project, where he said around 10% of homes were vacant on census night, which is, it's kind of, I mean, it's like sort of misleading, but I don't, when I looked at it, it hasn't, it's not as though it has been completely debunked in that the message that is conveyed by that fact, like it is true, there are quite likely, based on the information that we have, more homes left vacant right now than people sleeping, people who need a home, people who are homeless. So the way that census figure works is like it could include, it's basically anyone who hasn't like put in their census form for that property on the night. So it literally could include people who just weren't home, for example, on the night that the census was conducted and just didn't return a form. It also could be that there's like a changeover of the property, so the sale process, and maybe, yeah, there's vacant possession for like that week or so, and that happened to fall on census night. But the other thing that's in like the, you know, the kind of fact check articles on this is like, well, a lot of it's holiday homes. And it's like, well, yeah, that's bad. Like they talk about the fact that maybe,
you know, even everyone has and deserves a holiday home.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you, yeah, some every of them Australian are holiday
homes.
Has
like your holiday home would be empty, right?
You're like, yeah.
That's not, no. So yeah, like even maybe as many as half or potentially more, they know, they kind of tracked where these vacant homes were according to that data, and noticed that a lot of them were in like holiday places, you know, a lot of them were like closer to the coast or, and the census was conducted in winter. So it's more likely that they would be empty. So they're like, it's like, yes, probably a lot of them are holiday homes, but the ABS then, probably because they noticed that this figure kept being used and they were like, oh, it's not totally a complete representation. So they then released more data late last year in their housing snapshot, which said that around 136,000 homes have no sign of recent use, or had no sign of recent use as of June 2021. And this is using like a bunch of, it's kind of an experimental way of getting that figure. They break down a bunch of different things that they use, but it's, you know, for example, like has electricity been used there in recent times? And so 136,000 homes is still a lot when you consider
that's
that
a lot of homes.
Census night.
Yeah.
There were an estimated 122,494 people who were homeless. So
yes.
Still, yes, more empty homes than homeless people, which is particularly relevant when, yeah, you have these developers and conservatives just pushing the line that the only problem is supply, not the tax system, not skyrocketing rents, not profiteering, whatever, not land banking. Mm. Like, you know, there are homes. Yeah.
I mean, that stat, I think, yeah, I never took it to mean that, hey, look, there are a million homes that could all be used. Into. You know, yeah. could be, yes, like, I, obviously there are a whole bunch of exceptions in there. It was a statistic to point to the fact that there are shitloads of houses out there being used for lots of different reasons and to question the supply narrative. Because because unless you are also willing to acknowledge that property investment and the incentive to own shitloads of homes to make lots of money is a restriction on the supply of housing for everyone to secure housing for everybody across this country, then you're talking nonsense. If you don't agree with me that a guy having 238 investment properties isn't a problem when it comes to talking about housing affordability and home ownership in this country, I don't know what we're talking about. So citing this fact for saying, yes, obviously there's not a million homes that could immediately be handed over and, you know, nationalized by the state and handed over to homeless people. But, you know, as you say, if in this, as you dig a little deeper, 136,000 homes that are sitting there empty. I mean, and recent use would be what? We're talking about months and months and months, right?
At least. I'm not sure exactly what period that is, but I mean, I would imagine it would represent, yes, that no one's fucking using it. Like a reasonable person would assume that means it's effectively abandoned. I mean, I don't know if that's, I wonder if it's around 6 months or slightly less given that that's the figure that's often used in vacancy taxes, which maybe, that is the solution that Geordie says that that's one thing that, that could be done. He says there should be a national residential vacancy tax that is, quote, prohibitive. So not necessarily, you know, this isn't a tax to try and raise revenue to fund things necessarily. It's a tax to try and disincentivize people from just holding on to homes and leaving them empty when people need them. And as I understand it, Victoria is the only state right now in Australia that has an empty homes tax. They have their vacancy tax introduced in 2017 and expanded maybe late last year with help of the Greens to cover the whole state. Before, it was just like inner city councils that if they were unoccupied for more than 6 months in a year, then the owner is liable to pay 1% of the property's total value for this tax. But that was, it'll be expanded, like comes into effect from next year across the state, with exemptions for holiday homes, of course, and things like if the owner's doing renovations. And but that's only for empty homes. For undeveloped land from 2025, I think it'll be if it's left for five plus years without developing it. That's quite a long time. But yes,
5 years, Jesus Christ.
Yes, so they can just sit on it. And think of the capital gains that you can make if you're sitting on, you know, especially if it's like kind of prime real estate and just doing nothing, sitting on your fucking hands for 5 years, you probably, I wouldn't be surprised if you could make more than 1% of the value in capital gains. But anyway.
Property developers are lazy. No one wants to work anymore. People just want to sit on their fucking land, the squatocracy.
Who was in power in Victoria in 2017? Like who introduced the vacancy tax?
That would have been the Andrews government.
It was Andrews, yeah.
Yes, yes. They won in 2014, yeah.
Yeah, I actually didn't realise, like I maybe sort of vaguely heard about this but hadn't properly clocked that, Victoria is the only state that's done this. And what the Greens did when they, so I think they must have been in the balance of power to pass this legislation expanding the scheme, and they negotiated a higher rate that scales up year by year. So after it's left vacant for the second year, then it goes from 1% up to 2%. And if it's 3 years or more, I assume, then it goes up to 3%. So that it really is trying to incentivize, you know, not just leaving it vacant forever and ever. It's still, that's, you know, still substantially less than what the Greens have proposed elsewhere. I actually couldn't find if other Greens bodies in different states and territories had proposed this or if we've proposed a national rate, but I know in Queensland, the proposal that Amy McMahon put forward for an empty homes tax was 5% of the value. And that includes undeveloped land if you're just land banking, if it's on a, you know, if it's not used for more than 6 months in the year, and it also includes Airbnb. So that's, yeah, that's exempted from the Victorian laws, but it would include holiday homes if they are, you know, not occupied by a permanent resident for more than 6 months in a year. 5%, which would, I would imagine, that is getting closer to prohibitive.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, yeah, you scratch this, there's just a little bit and it all comes out, right? The fundamental contradiction between anybody suggesting that we should do something about the housing crisis, but their red line is encroaching in any way on property rights for investors and people who own property, right? Yeah. So I think the Libertarian Party, for example, retweeted or quote-tweeted Pebble Figures and said, we believe in property rights, this is a crime or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, John's been very funny on the responses. It's like, where does all this, someone said, where does all this lead? And he just replied, your mum's house, which I thought was great. But yes, this idea that, you know, you see it again and again in landlord discourse, this is my property. This is my property. Mm-hmm. I have rights over it. Fuck your rights. Yeah. Fuck your ability to have a pet or I pay for it. It's all mine. Yeah. You're actually lucky to be living here. And I'm actually a pretty great person for providing you with this housing. This is my property and you're not allowed to be in there. And my, if, you know, I'm allowed to do whatever I want with my property. If I want to leave it vacant for years on end and making money, that's my right. And the state should enforce violence against you if you point that out, that being wrong, and you want to do something horrific, like squatting there, like living under a roof and finding shelter in this property that I'm keeping empty, for fuck's sake.
And again, it comes back to, you know, that response that Max Chandler-Mather gave to the woman on Q&A when she's like, why are landlords demonized when, you know, I'm struggling, blah. And it's like the difference that we're talking about is, you know, what do you lose? Maybe, yes, you might lose some you might lose financially because you're not getting the benefit of receiving rent for renting out your place, or I don't know, your property rights are encroached on, compared to someone sleeping on the streets. Like those are the issues. Those are the damage that we're comparing here. And for some reason, that doesn't register. Like those are equal in these people's minds, which is just absolutely unfathomable. It's insane. And it is absolutely near.
It's not my problem. It's just, you know, like,
It
is, again, just the death of social solidarity, the death of the concept, which neoliberalism has shot in the face, this concept that we have any obligations to other people. I'm looking after my shit. I'm fine, Jack. You know, you do your thing.
Yeah.
The guarantee of your basic human rights cannot encroach on my life or
as if
reduce
no
my
support.
Rights in any way.
Yeah, it's like as if because they worked for it. And it's like, actually, no, because the entire system was set up to enable you to buy this property. Like, yes, you paid for it under what economic system, like that enabled you to, whatever, inherit a huge amount of wealth without being taxed or, you know, dodge taxes on a personal level, or whether capital gains tax incentivized you to treat housing this way, or you were able to negatively gear something, like all of that.
But you're just born in the 60s. You're just born at a certain time.
Yes, or you're born at a certain time. Exactly. Anyway, yes, the outrage is fun. Geordie's responses are even more fun. I recommend just like having a look at what's been going on his Twitter. I think it's just at Purple Pingers. Especially also just the, as Americans realize what pingers are and like even just, you know, media realize what pingers are and having to kind of grapple with that this guy actually taking on quite a serious matter does it in this, yeah, like this kind of light way. I think he does that really well. I think he's doing fantastic work. Something that, you know, a register of vacant homes is something that people have been talking about for a while. I know Jonathan Tree-Ranganathan, and I think we've mentioned before, has been going on about wanting to do it for years and had sort of, he posted back in 2022 about potentially using census data to identify empty homes and how you could potentially squat in them. And that was one of the things that was then seized on and, you know, used relentlessly against him in attacks of accusing him of supporting breaking and entering during the council election. But fuck yeah, I support, you know, Geordie's kind of making it mainstream because as people pointed out, squatting is not a new thing. There are like squatters handbooks that exist for different states. It's been happening for a long time. And yeah, like mainstream it until if it genuinely means that people feel, oh, maybe it's not sustainable to just land bank and leave a property empty, maybe I should actually let someone live there and not count on the capital gains, that's a great outcome.
Is it worth talking about this insane reaction from Victorian Shadow Housing Minister Richard Riordan?
Oh, yeah. What did he say?
He said that he was making rude assumptions about landlords. And is it, so his argument is the problem is minimum standards in Victoria are so strict that perfectly livable houses are no longer rentable. So, okay, so the housing market is too regulated and that's why these landlords are keeping these properties vacant.
Particularly ironic in the context of, Geordie's other work, which is shitrentals.org, which exposes how extremely not perfectly livable these homes are and, like, how extremely important the minimum standards that, you know, the Victorian government have introduced are, and that they're not even anywhere near good enough because there are still properties that are rented out that are fucking shitholes. Of course, it's always really hard for landlords, and actually the laws are all in favour of tenants and things are really hard for them.
I must say, I joined some landlord Facebook groups when I was writing my book to get some comedy gold. I haven't checked in on them. I'd love to see how this is going off in the chat.
How they're doing.
Speaking of squatters, let's talk about Israel.
Yes, point has been made. Not Tom's joke.
Damn it. Still my laugh. Let's check back in on the latest in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. We've now crossed the six-month mark, of course, on April 7th, 6 months of horror. And we didn't get a chance last week to sort of talk about the latest developments, the big story, of course.
Wait, sorry. Well, I mean, then if we are going to make that joke, so they would be liable for a vacancy tax in Victoria. Israel,
I guess so, yes.
No, yes. But yes, so the occupation's been going on for much longer than 6 months, isn't it? Maybe we should cut that out.
We cut it out?
Who knows?
Okay, great. Well, we'll let Mike decide.
Leave it to Mike. See you.
We get to sort of talk about this, of course, this big development, what many are calling this turning point in the war, apparently. We might have some skepticism about that, but we had this IDF drone strike that killed 7 World Central Kitchen aid workers, including a 43-year-old Australian Zomi Francom. They were in a deconflicted zone. They were in clearly branded WCK vehicles, had the logo on it on the side and the top of the vehicles, I believe. They'd been coordinating their movements with the IDF, but were still victims of what Israel has said was an unintentional airstrike.
Mm-hmm.
Real whoopsies stuff, you know?
Yeah, they do lots of whoopsies, don't they?
And it was crazy. I don't know if you heard the details, but like airstrike on one vehicle, survivors get out of that. Some people run, make it to the second vehicle, which then gets struck. And then again, that happens with the third. Like just truly unhinged shit. It's when you're reading the details about it, you're like, this is bonkers. IDF sources reportedly said the attack happened because every commander sets the rules for himself. And there was an erroneous suspicion that a terrorist was traveling with the convoy. I saw some commentary. They were like, the vehicles look like the ones that we used on October 7th. The IDF is just getting triggered, just having flashbacks now. Pressing a super targeted drone strike.
Yeah, great.
The most moral army in the world. Benjamin Netanyahu's called it tragic, saying it happens in war. We check it to the end. We're in contact with the governments and we will do everything so that this does not happen again. Will you though, mate?
No. Everything? Yeah,
The consequences have been really harsh. An IDF spokesman said that 2 officers involved had been stood down from their roles due to their involvement in the strike, but only 1, a reservist, had been removed from the IDF entirely. The other one is being investigated. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay.
There's been international condemnation. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said the aid workers' deaths were completely unacceptable and has demanded full accountability. And I don't know, people might have been reading, you know, profiles on Zomi Francom. She seemed like a pretty extraordinary person who'd, you know, traveled around the world providing food and aid to people who desperately needed it. And, of course, her family is grieving and it's horrific.
Yeah.
Having said that, I mean, there's a conversation around the reaction to these deaths and, like, okay, some people are waking up to how horrific this war is. Is it better late than never? Is it an actual turning point? What do you think?
If it is an actual turning point, that's great. But, yeah, like, you can't help but think when Anthony Albanese says this death is clearly unacceptable, that there's an implication that the deaths, the thousands and thousands of deaths, including, you know, women and children, civilians, prior to that, were acceptable, which, just boggles the mind.
Crazy. And it gets even in my head, like this nationalist idea sort of to poison you. Like at one point I find myself thinking, of course, I guess it's reasonable that the Australian government would be more vocal or outraged about the death. And then I go, hang on, no, that's not reasonable at all. We should be actually as outraged at the death of all, if all innocent life matters and is equal, as we constantly say, as a, you know, a cliche that we constantly regurgitate, we should be absolutely outraged at the 32,000 deaths that have already been murders, really, that have been committed by Israel, including 13,000 children, for fuck's sake. But even then, it's like more than 196 aid workers have been killed in Gaza since October, according to the US-funded aid worker security database, which I had no idea about, of course.
So it's not even
We've
just
heard a lot about
position.
The deaths of journalists and stuff.
Yeah.
Sorry, what was that?
So it's not even just about their position.
No, right. Yeah. Yes. So I guess the question is, what is it? Is it the egregious nature of this particular, the cruel, cold-hearted idea of killing people, feeding the hungry with drone strikes? Is it just this point at the war that the pressure's been building? I don't know. What do you think?
Is it because so many died at once? Like, I assume maybe those 196 were kind of spread out. I'm not sure.
I mean, from our point of view, I assume this is the first Australian aid worker that's been killed.
Oh, yeah. In terms of the Australian government's response, it's obviously just because they're Australian, which, yeah, that's what is a weird
Australian
thing.
Mentioned. Some truly pathetic responses from our political leaders. Again, Albanese said, I conveyed to Prime Minister Netanyahu in very clear terms that Australians were outraged by this death, by this tragedy of this fine Australian. Australians will look at this and be deeply, deeply concerned that someone going about their work providing aid in an exercise of humanity could lose their life in this way. Albanese said he'd made clear again, it's Australia's view that humanitarian assistance must reach people in Gaza unimpeded and in large quantities. But Albanese did not give a direct answer when asked whether he had spelled out any potential consequences to Netanyahu if Israel did not conduct a satisfactory investigation into Frank Comb's death or change the course of its war more generally.
Okay, so a stern talking to.
Stern talking to. We've done a bit of that, actually. We've expressed concerns. Mm. We've called for restraint. We've done a lot of calling and talking and making it clear and making our notions and making calls and things, and it just doesn't seem to change anything. It's kind of
weird.
It doesn't
seem to change anything. I mean, not recognising that what we and the Greens and other people in support of a free Palestine have been saying for a long time is call for a ceasefire, not to say that the Australian government doesn't have any power with what they publicly call for and support and state, because it is the institutional support for Israel's actions that have kind of enabled them to do what they've done for decades, let alone the last 6 months. But yes, there are certainly things that the Australian government could be doing beyond simply stern talkings to, or even just calling for, you know, the provision of aid. They could be doing a lot more to ensure that safe provision of aid, for example.
Yeah. And they could stop providing military support. Again, exactly. I was reading about this a little bit. So the government likes to say, oh, Australia hasn't exported any arms to Israel over the past since the war began, or indeed over the past 5 years. And you go, oh, okay. But then you look into it a little bit deeper, and what they mean is like this non-lethal, like this stuff that isn't considered a weapon, right? So we still provide supports that are used in like F-35 planes that are being used to kill Palestinians.
Yeah.
But it's not technically classified as a weapon because it's just a part of something that's used in the death machine more broadly. So we get away with that. And we've awarded a $917 million military contract to Elbit Systems. This is to provide us with our own, military hardware. I think they're tanks or something like that. Elbit, of course, an Israeli defense company that is absolutely supplying the IDF with the very weapons that they're using to kill children and kill aid workers and kill our own citizens.
Well, wasn't Elbit responsible for the strike that killed these aid workers directly? I think I saw Max Chandler-Mather tweeting about that,
Incredible stuff. So we should be sanctioning this country. We should be stopping all aid, and we should be sanctioning this fucking country, for God's sakes. But no, we're just expressing our concerns with no consequences. Penny Wong says she spoke with the Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz on Tuesday evening, reiterated that unless Israel, Mr. Netanyahu, changes his course of action, Israel will continue to lose international support. Okay, and what will it? What and... Because they're doing all these horrible things in America and us, we're still on board. Yeah. We say to Mr. Netanyahu, you must change course, Wong said. Pressed on whether Israel was ignoring such demands, Wong said nation states made their own decisions, and those decisions may include acting in ways which diminish their standing internationally.
What? What are you saying?
Not my precious standing.
Yeah.
I thought this was good. The president of the Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, APAN, Nasser Mashini, called on the Australian government to hold Israel to account for its continual breaches of international law and to avoid weak language. This is not a tragedy. This is a crime.
Mm.
I think that's really important. We saw tragedy being wheeled out a hell of a lot in response to these aid workers' deaths. Like, nah, man.
Yeah, that's right.
Shadow Foreign Affairs spokesman Simon Birmingham said the deaths should never have happened, but these tragedies are just part of what has been an enduring tragedy since the barbaric attacks from Hamas.
Oh, so it's barbaric attacks when it's from Hamas, but it's a tragedy IDF strikes on aid workers.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Sure.
I mean, and we saw this a lot. I think Greg Sheridan had a full piece in this show. Like, seriously blaming the IDF killing these aid workers with a drone strike on Hamas, right? Israel has no responsibility for all this. It's all their, it's all Hamas's fault. Like seriously trying to make this case that you can't blame Israel. Israel's the best, most moral army in the world. They're doing everything they can to reduce civilian casualties, but not our fault. Yeah. They started it.
It's like, do you really need to be like a parent talking to a child? It's like, I understand he moved over to your side of the car seat, but you've hit him.
Yeah,
and that's not okay, all right? And they're like, but, like, don't fucking care. Don't want to hear it. You just bombed fucking aid workers and you've killed thousands and thousands of children, so.
Yeah, not fair. There's going to be an investigation into this by the IDF, of course. I'm sure that will be rigorous and unbiased.
So rigorous, yeah.
We've appointed former Defence Chief Mark Binken to scrutinise the Israeli response and that investigation. Albanese said, we expect him to have full access, and there's been reporting this week that that's probably not going to happen, that the IDF will absolutely stop him from looking at everything. It's a whole fucking sham.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting is, again, our direct complicity in this. Okay, so the reason why there is World Central Kitchen staff there, the reason why Palestinians are starving, and the UN tells us that something like 70% of Gaza's population is facing catastrophic hunger. It is basically a famine right now. Mm-hmm. People are probably reading horrific stories about what Palestinian people are forced to eat in these circumstances. A big part of why that is so acute and terrible is because we suspended funding for UNRWA, right? The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, which Australia did based on spurious allegations that UNRWA were complicit in the October 7 Hamas attacks, which Israel pulled out of their fucking ass on the same day. The ICJ hands down they're finding they could be engaging in potential genocide. We unequivocally accepted those allegations, suspended funding for UNRWA for a long period of time. America still suspended its funding, my understanding is. And so we are complicit in the starving of these people and the increased need for aid workers. So, again,
acted
more
real
blood
quickly
on
in that instance to withdraw support for, you know, the machinery that we believe to be causing death. Like,
yes.
Interesting how they would do that, but it's really hard to withdraw support for, you know, provision of weapons to Israel. Like,
we've also been learning wonderful facts about the IDF's AI-generated kill list. Do you hear any of this kind of nonsense?
Vaguely, yeah, tell me.
New testimony from 6 Israeli intelligence officers that the IDF bombing campaign uses an AI-powered database that has identified 37,000 potential targets. The system can specify likely civilian deaths prior to attacks, with the military at times explicitly permitted to kill 15 or 20 civilians during airstrikes on low-ranking militants.
15 or 20 civilians.
Yep. I don't know what the rank. I don't know
but
if there's a chart.
But they're only
Palestinian
civilians, so, you know.
Yeah, well, who gives a fuck? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that is like Terminator shit. That's like dystopian future shit. And this is our ally. This is the democracy. This is the country that we are standing by and endorsing and trying to hold up as this incredible country that deserves our support in the Middle East. Like, truly, batshit stuff. So we also had this intervention from Penny Wong this week. She gave a speech at ANU College's Securing Our Future conference on Tuesday night. Did we get an invite to that? Do we?
I didn't. I don't know. We've got so many emails. It could have just got lost. Potentially one of the invitations that we, didn't get to.
Hello at seriousdangerpod.com if you want to get in touch. Serious Danger Live at the Securing Our Future conference.
Securing Our Futures.
And she gave this speech. There was a lot of reporting around it, but again, looking into it, I've read the speech. It's kind of a nothing burger, but even the response to the nothing burger gives you an indication of where the debate around Palestinian statehood, Palestinian justice, and Israel's genocidal war is at. Australia's Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong says the recognition of a Palestinian state is the only hope to break the endless cycle of violence in the Middle East, and a two-state solution would help ensure long-term security of Israel and further undermine Hamas. So basically, she's floating the idea of Australia recognising Palestinian statehood as a means to get to peace.
So she hasn't, has the government not said this before? Because I understand that that's, like, that's Labor policy, right?
Yes.
But the
yes.
government hasn't said this yes and yet, and that's why it's significant.
Yes, and perhaps in the context, you know, post-October 7th, I suppose, in response to the current conflict. But yes, in 2021, and we talked about this before, Wong moved an amendment at the Labor Party conference to elevate a resolution that calls on the next Labor government to recognise Palestine as a state, and expects that this will issue that this issue will be an important priority for the next Labor government. So pretty pretty strong language there, passed at the conference, which of course isn't binding on any Labor government.
Yeah.
And it was all very vague. They're basically like saying this is a matter for the next Labor government.
Yeah.
But so the slight difference here is like Australia unilaterally recognising Palestinian statehood as opposed to saying that a Palestine state is the end of a two-state peace process.
Yeah, yeah.
Which should not be controversial. There are 139 countries that already recognise Palestine, okay? But, of course, the status quo is like you wouldn't do that without Israel's approval, or Israel needs to agree to the recognition of what the Palestinian statehood means.
Yeah.
So that's the big bombshell that she's put out there. And we will get to what she actually said. And don't worry, she did mention the Greens, guys. Don't worry. The Greens political party did get a run in this speech.
Okay.
But I'm interested in your thoughts about, like, even this question and the debate around one state, two state in the current context. I don't know. Do those terms even have meaning or relevance to the situation right
Barely
now?
Barely at this point. I mean, I know, yeah, so, like, the Greens used to, I believe, I think that our policy used to support a two-state solution. You can go back and look at, you know, previous speeches that senators gave kind of in support of Palestine that were advocating for a two-state solution.
Yes.
But that was changed in, I don't know, the last few years where there was that new resolution on Israel and Palestine. And that resolution says that Israel's ongoing occupation, you know, Israel's activities have rendered a two-state solution effectively impossible.
Yeah.
And I think, like, that was the case when that resolution was passed, and surely that situation has disintegrated, you know, immeasurably further since the 7th of October, Hamas attacks, and, you know, particularly Israel's retaliation to those attacks. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
But yes, and particularly the context there now is like Netanyahu has specifically rejected the idea of a two-state solution. So even the pretense that, hey, Israel wants a two-state solution, we all want a two-state solution, is just bullshit. Yeah. And so then the pivot is, well, the Netanyahu government is bad and Netanyahu doesn't want a two-state solution and we need a more moderate Israeli government to come in and figure this out. And you're like, where is this political push within Israel for a two-state solution that is anyway serious? It doesn't seem to exist to me. And, in fact, the genocidal psychopaths that are currently making up the Israel government are doing perfectly relatively well to have a level of support from the Israeli
public. And how could you trust, like, how could you trust that that solution would actually be genuinely implemented in good faith by Israel when, like, every agreement that has been struck or when borders have been drawn, like, they've encroached on them and they fucking enabled illegal settlements, you know, on the West Bank. Like, I just don't, like, looking at the actual reality really makes you question the theoretical idea of just a peaceful two-state solution as supported by Israel, you know, together with Palestine.
And I think what we're seeing from figures like Penny Wong or, you know, or the Biden administration, two-state solution is a get-out-of-jail term. It's a way to dodge more pressing questions about what Israel's doing right now. Yeah, both sides, exactly. And to delay and push things down, kick the can down the road. And, you know, saying even the, you know, the Greens position say, well, you know, Israel needs to end the occupation. If you actually want to get anything towards peace, that's a fundamental part of it. Whereas, I mean, I suppose in theory, in their policy, Labor acknowledges that Israel's occupation of Palestine is legal. But we've been seeing, you've been seeing people respond to this saying, oh, Israel doesn't occupy Gaza, as if Israel has no say whatsoever. The borders and what goes in and out of that territory since they left in 2006 and then Hamas took over. Like they're still rolling that kind of bullshit line.
Yeah. It treats it as like a really distant and abstract issue that it's like those guys, they need to sort out their differences first. And, like, particularly It separates the colonial project of Israel from like the entire colonial project that is supported by the US and Australia and, you know, other kind of imperial states. And yes, like, I think that that's what the two-state solution as figured by the Labor Party and people like Wong does is wash our hands of it by casting it just as, you know, it's like when people cast it as it's like, oh, religion has just caused so much trouble in the world. Yes. You know, why can't the Jews and the Muslims just stop fighting over whose God is right? And it's like, that's not what this is. It's a settler colonial project. And it has, you know, really clear similarities with other settler colonial projects across the world, and Australia is one of them.
Mm. And yeah, you're right. The both sides thing allows you to ignore the fact that one of these sides is occupied and oppressed. And yes,
exactly.
Very big difference. One of them gets billions of dollars in funding from the superpower that is America, and the other one doesn't even have fucking statehood, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
Moving through the speech briefly, again, pretty boring across the board, but Penny Wong said on Tuesday, we need to build the pathway to a peace that is enduring and just, because the simple truth is that a secure and prosperous future for both Israelis and Palestinians will only come with a two-state solution, recognition of each other's right to exist, a Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel. Which, again, when you say something like that, immediately, okay, you start asking questions like, okay, but is it a united Palestine? Because we've got two occupied territories that are, you know, cut off by Israel. Separated, so is Israel going to cede territory? Are they going to come together, living alongside? What do you mean? And we've got, what, 500,000 settlers in the West Bank there. So what happens? They seem really keen on staying there and expanding their settlements, and they're actually backed in by the Israeli government in doing that, like literally given guns in order to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from there. So what's the two sides' sensible centrist approach to that, Penny Wong?
They just have to work it out, you know.
So she sort of says, oh, you know, her case is like, this is in Israel's interests, for Israel's security. We need a two-state solution. You need Palestinian statehood. But then she has all these conditions. So there's no role for Hamas in a future Palestinian state. Hamas is a terrorist organization which has the explicit intent of the destruction of the state of Israel and the Jewish people. It should be acknowledged that Hamas also rains terror on Palestinian people. It has long been understood that any future Palestinian state cannot be in a position to threaten Israel's security and will need a reformed Palestinian authority. So that's like a huge caveat. Like what do you think Israel thinks a sovereign Palestinian state is, if not a threat to its own security? Right, like
that's so true.
Like, what do you think it is?
Zionists say that a call for a free Palestine is a call for the erasure of Israel, and often they'll, you know, erasure of Jewish people in general. Like, when that is a common view professed by Zionists, like, how can you take that seriously? Like, you have to remember that that is their perspective and their belief.
Mm. Recognizing a Palestinian state, one that can only exist side by side with a secure Israel, doesn't just offer the Palestinian people an opportunity to realize their aspirations. It also strengthens the forces for peace and undermines extremism. It undermines Hamas, Iran, and Iran's other destructive proxies in the region. A two-state solution is the only hope of breaking the endless cycle of violence. Now, I would say that there is at least something in this, a recognition that the existence of Hamas or the existence of a Palestinian resistance movement is a response to the occupation. So yes, if you actually want peace, you do need to change the material conditions and end the illegal occupation and guarantee the safety and human rights of everybody there. Like, in that, I find the same kernel of wisdom that says, hey, if you kill all the Hamas people and kill all these children, guess what? Something will replace them immediately. As long as the status quo continues, you know, the cycle of violence will absolutely continue. So I would, I don't know. I think there's probably something
that's
to that.
That's helpful. Like, like, I think that that's a, you know, I can understand if you are a centrist being like that's probably one of the more valuable contributions that you can make. You're still wrong on a broad level, and it's not quite there, but it's true. Like, I think people need to recognize what and why Hamas is and why it exists.
Yes, because many, particularly, you know, apologists for Israel, will represent Hamas as an organization that is completely devoid from its own material circumstances and is simply filled with a desire to kill as many Jewish people as possible, just a burning anti-Semitism that drives their every single motive, and it's completely disconnected with the fact that their people are living under an illegal, ongoing occupation and that they've been ethnically cleansed from their own country. Mm. As if that has no relevance to their actions and their strategies.
They have no fucking military. Like, they don't. Yes, yeah.
Did you see the Four Corners on Israel at all? It was John Lyons interviewing, like, former Israeli intelligence officers, a former president as well, and some of them were like, if I was Palestinian, I'd absolutely be in Hamas. I would absolutely be taking up arms in that part of resistance. It was fast. And these were, you know, not – these were people who were – critical of some of Israel's strategy, or at least certainly acknowledging that what's the status quo cannot continue. But they were just like, yeah, that's just anyone with a brain can see why these people are doing this. Yeah.
Yeah.
But look, you're given a big speech, you're the foreign affairs minister, there's lots of stuff going on, we've got massive conflicts, the planet's on fire. It's important to dedicate time to talking about the Greens.
Oh, is it?
We have to keep listening to each other, respecting each other, but I've heard language demonstrating that people are losing respect for each other's humanity, blatant anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia. I've heard people who claim to represent one perspective diminishing the legitimacy of the other, seeking to intimidate and blame me, Petty Wong, the Foreign Affairs Minister. I'm getting a lot of angry emails right now. It's not okay to blame anyone in Australia for the actions of Hamas. It's not okay to blame anyone in Australia for the actions of the Netanyahu government. Can we blame people for supporting the Netanyahu government? Can we do that?
The way she's skirting around being like, stop talking about how we're exporting weapons.
And it's not okay to excuse egregious acts just because they're done by people whose views you share. We gain nothing by reproducing the conflict here by talking past each other, yada, yada, yada. As I said, we're a pluralist country. What unites us is respect for each other and our right to live in peace. Yet there are too many politicians in Australia who are manipulating legitimate and heartfelt community concern for their own ends. The Greens political party is willing to purposely amplify disinformation, exploiting distress in a blatant and cynical play for votes, with no regard for the social disharmony they are fueling. This is not some game. There are consequences. Absolutely go fuck yourself, Penny Wong. Go fuck yourself in the face.
Source? Like, what the fuck is she talking about? Yeah, what, like, I would love an example of the disinformation that the Greens are amplifying in a cynical play for votes.
Yeah, it'd be good to clarify. If you think we're putting disinformation there, what are you talking about? Maybe you should clarify what the truth is then, Penny Wong, there, unless you're saying anything. Yeah. That's probably a reference to us talking arming Israel and sending weapons to the Israeli state, I reckon.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, but you don't want to specify what it is because, A, you want this to act as a dog whistle so that whoever it is, you know, so that Zionists can go, oh, yeah, the disinformation is that Palestine exists, or people who've heard that we're sending weapons to Israel can be like, oh, that must be the disinformation, without actually examining whether that is true or not and how actually it is fucking true. But really this just reads like they're fucking mad because people, particularly in Muslim communities, are voting for the Greens instead of them, and they're scared they're going to lose seats to us. Like, that's fucking cynical.
We're not fueling social disharmony. Your support for Israel is fueling disharmony. The killing of 13,000 children is what's fueling social disharmony. That's why people are upset. And the Greens are doing the job of a fucking left-wing political party by speaking up against that, speaking up for what they believe in, and calling out the genocidal war that your government is fucking supporting.
Well, and that is exactly, I was going to say, it's like this whole fucking outrage over the use of the word genocide, like how that is painted as the worst thing you can do, because these people are genuinely more concerned with using the word genocide than with the act of genocide.
Acts of genocide.
Like, that is the difference between their movement and ours. Like, that's fucking wild.
Extraordinary. Yeah, social disharmony is anyone criticizing Labor? The disinformation is saying that the Labor government is doing bad things, and that maybe we shouldn't have suspended funding to an aid organization during a genocidal war that were providing important humanitarian relief because of the spurious claims made by an apartheid regime. That's disinformation. That's craziness.
I mean, I remember Jonathan Sriranganathan again talking about this at one point, because he would often be labeled divisive. And he said something like, there's a difference between being divisive, causing division, and pointing out divisions that exist in society.
Yes.
And it's that thing where people are like, you're being divisive because you say that, you know, police have a problem with racism. And it's like, no, I'm pointing out division.
Yes.
I'm pointing out racism. That's not that's not causing the division.
Yes. Yeah,
like, we're not the ones causing the disharmony. We're not the ones causing the fucking problem here. The problem is the genocide. The problem is the occupation and the violence, you know.
Preach. And then at the end, of course, you know, again, all this, oh, we want peace and justice. And then she, of course, finishes by heaping praise on the United States, our closest ally, our principal strategic partner, and our largest source of foreign investment. We share values and ideals, and our alliance is underpinned by mutual respect for each other's sovereignty and national interests, except for Pine Gap. Apparently, don't give a fuck about that. Anyway, just basically saying, as I've said before, American leadership remains indispensable. It is the great builder of alliances and networks, essential for balance in a multipolar region. Absolutely. Once again, I mean, it's exactly what you would expect, of course, from a Labour foreign minister in 2024, but that doesn't make it right. And thank God, again, the Greens exist to say, no, America actually sucks, particularly on Gaza, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
And we should resist the empire and have our own foreign policy, please.
Yeah.
Anyway, I give this speech 3 stars. That's
3 stars.
Which is the greatest insult.
That's what you're saying.
You can give any performer at all.
You're saying it was perfect, the perfect mix, perfect balance.
But, you know, so she barely said anything there. She just reiterated the policy of the Labour government. And, of course, but the response was insane. People losing their minds. Of course, the Zionist lobby is saying this, you know, Palestinian statehood would reward Hamas and terrorism. Others are saying, of course, it's far too soon after the October 7th attacks. I'm not sure exactly when, how long we can wait before you recognize people's humanity and dignity and try and actually resolve this issue that you seem to love to perpetuate. Simon Birmingham said that Penny Wong seemed to be trying to fast-track a two-state solution, which is hilarious in the context of a 75-year occupation.
Yes.
And we're 30 years on from the Oslo Accords. But, like, just slow down here, folks. Everyone.
Yeah.
Just chill out. And I haven't seen this interview. Thanks to Rachel Withers for tweeting this out. But Carl Stefanovic interviewed Anthony Albanese, and apparently... Apparently, Carl Stefanovic said, but separating Hamas and a Palestinian state is like kind of separating the milk and the dark chocolate and the Cadbury top deck.
No, it's not.
That's on the news. That was on the news.
This is the guy that does the news. That's the guy. Lots of people watch this guy, and he's like, I don't know, it's kind of like a top deck. I don't know. Or a caramello. Yeah, it's kind of like that, isn't it?
Oh, boy. I'm done.
You're done. Great.
Thanks. I'm Norm Macdonald, and now the fake news. Well, it is finally official. Murder is legal in the state of California.
A quick call to action. This week, Toondah Harbour was preliminarily rejected potentially. So Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek announced a preliminary decision or proposed decision to reject the Toondah Harbour development. For any folks who are not aware of this development, it is a proposal for about 3,600 apartments to be built on top of the water at Moreton Bay on these internationally protected wetlands. They're part of, you know, we are a signatory to the Ramsar Treaty to protect wetlands such as these. It would impact threatened species like koalas and migratory shorebirds, which is why it was referred to the EPBC. There's a whole lot of background to this development. If anyone hasn't kind of followed it, it's been going on for like almost a decade, huge community pushback, bunch of dodgy political donations. Like there was a $200,000 political donation to the Liberals right before Frydenberg, as Environment Minister at the time, overruled his own department's finding that the development was, quote, clearly unacceptable, and was like, let's just review it a little bit more. And God. That's, you know, ever since then has the federal environmental assessment been going on. The Queensland government has like a secret development agreement with the developer and the local council to deliver this as a priority development. They have spent at least $67,000 that we know of in court defending their right to not release that after people appealed, you know, after the Information Commissioner said it should be made public. Mm. So there's a whole lot of murky fucking shit about this shitty development. It is really exciting news that Plibersek has come out and indicated that she is going to reject it. But the fear is the developer has 10 days to respond. So does the public. I think my concern and the concern of a few people is that the developer will say, oh, well, we won't build 3,600 apartments on these internationally protected wetlands. We'll build 800 or, you know, something like that, a scaled down development. And then Labor goes, oh, well, in that case, that's okay then, even though it'll still fuck over this habitat for threatened species. Yeah. And, you know, all of that. So the call to action this week is to contact Minister Plibersek and really kind of drive home that message that any development on these wetlands is unacceptable, should be rejected. There is a script and a phone number at the link that we'll provide. It's greens.org.au/campaigns/protect-toondah, but we'll put the link in the show notes and you can check it out there.
Also want to give a quick shout out to the Jewish Council of Australia, the good one. There is a good peak body for progressive Jewish people who are serious about anti-Semitism, as we all should be, but who also are willing to criticise the state of Israel. And it's academics, people from lots of different life, Jewish Australians, who don't want to be represented by the likes of the Australian Jewish Association or the Zionist Federation or whatever you, and they want to speak up for Palestinian justice and for and against anti-Semitism and all the good things. Some very good people involved in that, and much love and solidarity to them. Jewishcouncil.com.au is their website. I also put the link in the show notes for these two websites that came up in my research. Apparently these websites that are listing how MPs have been voting and their attitude and approach to the war on Gaza, particularly, you know, South Africa's case in the ICJ on Israel's committing genocide, themuslimvote.com.au and muslimvotesmatter.com.au seem to be these websites that are sort of appraising and evaluating how certain MPs are voting. Could be interesting to take a look there and share them around.
Very interesting. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or if you're listening now, give us a 5-star review. It helps us very much. You can also support us by following us on social media at SeriousDangerAU, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. We're there. Thank you, Tom, for showing us the mug. If you would like to bring us a gift, like a mug or something else, you can come to one of our live shows. If you haven't got tickets yet and there are still tickets, check the website for the tickets to the 12 p.m. show in Mansion, Brisbane, on the 27th of April, or email us hello@seriousdangerpod.com or comment on one of our socials posts or whatever and let us know if you'd like us to do a live show somewhere else. Tell us where we should come next. You can also find merch and everything else at seriousdangerpod.com. All the links are there. We love you very much. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Serious Danger Australia.